live at the Phoenix Arts Club.
Do you want to give a shout out to your t-shirt now, Stephen?
Yeah, I've got a costume change.
Stephen's gone like Stevie Nicks, and he's... Oh, thank you very much. And you've done an intermission costume change, which you might want to show off to the...
I should say a very big thank you to Andrew from 66 Clothing here, who provided the very nice striped shirt that I was wearing in the first half. Andrew will be taking orders, so if anybody would like to. But is Mark here from Stuff by Mark?
It's like Twitter is real people. It's amazing. There we go.
If you or anyone you know has been affected by Philip Norman, call this number. He must be stopped. He must be stopped.
He must be stopped.
He must be stopped.
He must be stopped before he does the Ringo biography.
Oh. He never liked being a drummer.
No.
Or whatever.
Part two. Thank you for hanging around. We hope you're all refreshed. We want to continue with the story, and we want to talk about the Beatles' last show in Candlestick Park. What's the context for this? This is... They've been touring briefly, a world tour in 66, and they end up in the US.
Yes, so they're heading to America for the sort of final leg of the world tour. Anybody who subscribes will have heard us talk about the Butcher Sleeve incident. So this is where they put out an album. They have a slightly garish cover where they're in butcher's smocks. There's sort of dismembered dolls. There's pieces of meat. This does not go down well in America. Capitol have to recall the albums. Cost about $2 million in today's money to carry out this exercise. It's really the first piece of bad publicity that the Beatles have had in America. Hot on the heels of that is the Bigger Than Jesus controversy, where John says, you know, the Beatles are bigger than Jesus, except he never actually used that phrase. He said they were more popular than Jesus. But this has caused a storm. It's sort of escalating. As I say, the full story we told on a podcast, but they are literally flying into this storm. Brian Epstein has decided John is going to have to apologize for these comments. So the tour does not start on a high note. It starts with John having to make this apology.
Yeah, and you know, the Beatles, this is now 66, their world tour consisted of West Germany, Japan, and the Philippines. And the Philippines goes ferociously badly for them, and which we also discussed. And then this is the rest of the world tour, which is essentially a North American tour. There's one little diversion into Toronto. A lot of it's predominantly in the Northeast. There's one dip down south into Memphis, which will probably be the most contentious date of the tour.
Yeah.
And they're due to finish up in San Francisco at the end of the month. But they are flying into back-to-back controversies. Now, these tickets have been on sale for a couple of months. The tickets have been on sale predating any of these controversies from about March. The tour is not sold out. And they land in Chicago, and they thought, well, you've got back-to-back controversies, the Bigger Than Jesus controversies. When they get to Chicago, a press conference is what's called for.
Yeah, so they check into the Astor Hotel. You can look for it. It still is there, but it's now luxury condominium.
Yes. It's not a hotel anymore, sadly. And so they're called to do a press conference. And some of this footage is kind of familiar to, you know, anybody who's a significant Beatles fan, but it's worth looking at. We've got two clips from the press conferences where John is asked to atone and explain the Bigger Than Jesus controversy. So for the first one, you know, there's no rule book for what they're trying to do. It's very interesting to see him being defensive, or to think that he has a chance of actually trying to explain what he meant instead of just giving a full-on mea maxima culpa. But let's have a listen to the first of two clips.
Yeah, it's just straight like that. I can't imagine that, you know, that I've got the other way, except for if it had said we're more television is more popular than Jesus, I might have got away with it. In reference to England, that we meant more to kids than Jesus did, or religion at that time. I wasn't knocking it or putting it down, I was just saying it as a fact. And it is true, especially more for England than here, saying that we're better or greater, or comparing us with Jesus Christ as a person, or God as a thing, or whatever it is. You know, I just said what I said, and it was wrong, or was taken wrong, and now it's all this.
So that's John's famous, and now it's all this quote. There's one other clip which I quite like from this press conference where you get to see each individual Beatles response to the bigger than Jesus reaction. So you see Paul flipping it on its head, saying it's the other guy's fault. George trying to double down on what John says, and Ringo kind of saying, we want everyone to be friends. The bit you can't hear at the start, but it's quite funny, is the reporter says to John, do you think you're going to be crucified for this? Which is another nice bit of foreshadowing to the Ballad of John and Yoko, but John doesn't take the bait. Have a look.
Do you think you're being crucified?
No, I wouldn't say that at all.
How do you feel about the record burnings here in the United States?
Well, I think, you know, it's a bit silly. It seems a bit like a publicity stunt on their part, you know. I think, you know, they're not going to gain anything by doing that.
If they just didn't buy the records or didn't put them away, you know, but burning them is...
They just take it the wrong way, and that's just the pity that it's this misunderstanding which shouldn't be.
Well, I just hope it's all over now, you know. I hope everyone's straightened out and it's finished.
Oh, Ringo just wants everyone to get along and come on, guys, peace and love. You know, he's making a copper bronze statue of his peace sign right backstage. But, you know, at the same time, the Beatles are still going to number one. Revolver goes to number one this week in the UK. You know, the US ticket sales are down, but the gross receipts are up, which is the main thing.
Yeah, so the ticket sales are down, but they're still huge. You know, they're still playing to huge audiences. The deals that they are making are based on what happened the year before. So the promoters are being much more generous in terms of the percentage cut that the Beatles are getting. And many of these shows, including the one in Candlestick Park, the producers don't make any money. The Beatles make money, but the promoter, the deals they have, they don't make money.
So the final gig is due to happen in San Francisco. It's in Candlestick Park, which is, you know, big baseball arena with lots of parking. you know, good luck trying to find your car there. And it's the home of the San Francisco Giants, which is a team, not an experiment.
A sports team.
Yes. And the capacity was 42,500. And how many of those were sold?
25,000.
So not full by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
Tickets were $4.50 and $6.50, and the Beatles' fee was $90,000, and they took 65% of the gross, which is nice.
So San Francisco, the city, the local authority, took 15% of the gross and also got free tickets. As I say, the promoter actually, for all those ticket sales, the promoter actually lost money.
Hmm. Now, the thing is, though, going into this, the Beatles knew it was going to be their final concert. Or did they, but they did really, but did they, but they did. But this is really a decision that in that little gap between the Philippines gigs and these North American gigs, they have this unusual period in India that a lot of people don't talk about.
Brief holiday. There's a stopover in India. And originally this was just supposed to be George was going to stop over on the flight home from the Philippines. But with one thing and another in the Philippines, they all end up staying for a couple of days in India. And it's during this period that they hear Neil Aspinall and Peter Brown from their entourage talking about the fact that Brian has started to arrange tour dates for 1967. And the Beatles at this point say, no. So they tell Brian, either in India or on the flight home, they are saying to Brian, we are not touring. Now, Brian was already... I suppose you could say it was a sort of nervous exhaustion or a little bit of a sort of nervous breakdown, perhaps, as a result of the Philippines. This sort of exacerbates that. And whenever they get back, he goes into a sort of retreat or to recuperate in Port Marion,
yeah. To get himself together in the country.
Get himself together. Sort of like hope everybody knows Port Marion with the Prisoners film. I mean, hopefully they weren't filming The Prisoner.
That's not the kind of thing you want to see.
While
if you're
Brian
coming down
there,
off anything. No, it's just penny farthings.
No.
So there's all this kind of notion where they're kind of slowly, you know, they're setting up cameras to take their own pictures and, you know, they're going to record themselves and, you know, there's this kind of sense. And Ringo's in on this too.
Not so much. So again, there's this different recollection. So George will say, before one of the last numbers, we actually set up a camera with a sort of fisheye, wide-angle lens. We set it up on an amplifier. Ringo came off the drums, and we all stood with our backs to the audience and posed for a photograph because we knew this was the last show. Ringo says, there was a big talk at Candlestick Park that this had got to end. At that San Francisco gig, it seemed that it might possibly be the last time, but I was never 100% certain until we got back to London. John wanted to give up more than the others. He said that he'd had enough. So again, Ringo, still ambivalent.
Ambivalent, but also ready to go wherever the Beatles take him. Yeah. You know, bless. So let's talk about the day of the gig itself. This is themselves arriving. We've got a little bit of footage in a second, but the thing I want to point out, because I think it's quite interesting, is Paul is still holding a camera at all times. Any of you who have... I missed the Eyes of the Storm. You saw the Eyes of the Storm exhibition.
Anybody else see the Eyes of the Storm?
Yeah.
Brilliant, wasn't it? I mean, it was superb. Superb. That was 64. 66.
Where are the 66 photos? Free the 1966 film. Give us whatever.
65.
The knees of the lake or whatever it is. That'd be a good thing. So just keep an eye on Paul because he does have a camera at all times taking pictures. And this is, you know, when they arrive, you know, at the airport, you know, there's not the huge, massive crowds that you kind of see in the old newsreel footage waiting to see the Beatles. If you zoom in there, you know, Paul still has a bit of a smile on his face. George, yeah, not so much. You know, it's the thrill seems to be gone a little bit in their eyes. Here's here's a bit of silent footage from the day. And again, Paul's taking photos. Small crowd. Click, click goes Paul. There he is. Take another photo, Paul. But kind of subdued in you know, when you think of kind of Beatles arriving at airport footage. And this is the last time that this would happen. There's the money truck. And that's the bus. So they're not traveling in great luxury. No. They don't have... I know we're summoning Stevie Nicks a lot tonight, but it's not like, you know...
It's not like you and I arriving here.
No, with our pianos backstage and our buffets and all the rest. It's very austere what they're living
very
with.
Very austere. And they're traveling with the support act. And we have there's a very good book by Barry Tashian, who is a member of this of one of these support acts, and he describes this arrival. And he said, all of us on the bus were laughing like crazy. The driver headed to the outermost perimeter of the parking lot and began driving faster and faster around the park to escape the few fans that were there. Suddenly, in an attempt to get away from the growing convoy of fans following the bus, he exited the parking lot and began to drive around the neighborhood near the park. So we're just randomly cruising residential streets, completely lost. So eventually they do return to the stadium, they get in, the gates are open, and go to their sumptuous dressing room, which is basically the locker room for the sports.
It's the sports locker room, so the smell of it would have been great. And safely inside, one of the photographers there says there was a white tablecloth, a little bit of food, some beer, and some soft drinks. And people are passing through. Anyone who's there, you know, in the vicinity who wants to hang with the Beatles is there, including this chap. Anyone know who this chap is? This is Ralph Gleason. This is him here, and this is him a few years later with the moustache going on. And he was a San Francisco newspaper critic and columnist. But if you've seen his name at all or know his name at all, he was one of the founding editors of Rolling Stone magazine. And it's very interesting that we're kind of at this hinterland where, you know, London is swinging, but the next year it's all going to be about San Francisco, and people like Ralph Gleason are on the periphery. Well, they're not really on the periphery. They're kind of embedded in all of this, trying to, you know, bring the cultural scene alive in San Francisco. And he starts Rolling Stone the next year with everyone's favorite Jan Wenner. Boo. Okay, please yourselves. And but like most people, he falls out with Jan Wenner and is trying to extricate himself from Rolling Stone in 1975 when he gets a heart attack, unfortunately. But he was a very prominent cultural critic available at the time. And there's other people backstage as well.
Yeah, so Joan Baez is there. You've got the sort of basically anybody who is in San Francisco in that scene is passing through the dressing room.
So let's talk a little bit about the bill and the people who are there to kind of support the Beatles on the day. Here's my favorite guy.
I was going to say he's your favorite.
I love this guy. Emperor Gene Nelson of KYA 1260 AM. He's our compere for the day.
Possibly not an actual emperor.
Possibly not. He does say at the time the dressing room was chaos, loads of people there. The press tried to get passes for their kids, and Joan Baez was there. Any local celebrity who was in town was in the dressing room. They were having a party in there. It doesn't seem like the wildest of parties.
Nothing of which we have photographs.
I do have a small clip of DJ Emperor Gene Nelson in the 70s trying to do... I'll only play a small clip. I would watch this for hours. If you were to look at my YouTube history, it's full of this kind of tat. I swear. And here he is in the 1970s, but you can hear his kind of smarmy kind of talk.
But we have gone over the $100,000 mark, and as we promised, the person that put us over the top was going to get a cheer, a custom cheer. This will never has never been done before. It will never be done again. Once this cheer is done, it's dead. It may be dead in the process. The last arrives, and who is it to? Do you know?
Robert Davis.
Rob, you see?
There's a whole cheer. Look, I won't play it all. It goes on for about 15 minutes, but it's very exciting. But they do a cheer, and they raise money for the locals. Okay, it's not exciting at all. Fine. Be that way.
Okay.
But there are support acts as well. There so let's start with the Remains.
Anybody know of the Remains?
Yes. Anybody else?
Okay. Two people. The Remains, they're sort of a garage rock band from Boston, Massachusetts. And they're led by this chap, Barry Tashian, that I mentioned in the book. Their hit was Don't Look Back.
It's a Nuggets classic. If you've owned Nuggets, you know the Remains.
Compilation. And his
okay.
His book that I would really recommend is called Ticket to Ride, The Extraordinary Diary of the Beatles' Last Tour. And the fun fact, his son Daniel Tashian is the lead singer-songwriter in the Silver Seas. If anybody knows the Silver Seas?
Yeah.
A man in the front and a man at the back.
Next up on the support bill is Bobby Hebb. And now Bobby Hebb had a recent hit with Sonny. Now, top pop fact, you'd never heard of this song until we were prepping for this show.
No.
Which blows... Yeah, that blows my mind. Yeah, boo. If you've got any rotten fruit, throw it at Stephen now. I thought, this is just one of the loveliest songs. I'm sure you all know Sonny, but let's have a little listen.
Sonny, yesterday my life was filled with rain. Sonny, you smiled at me and really eased the pain. Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Here come James Bond
chords. Sunny,
in recent years, where's Billie Eilish doing it? Yep. Okay, I'll turn her off. You prefer Billie Eilish's earlier work like White Wedding.
White Wedding.
Hey.
Tough crowd.
He was that was his big hit. It was written about his brother.
It was written about his brother. His brother was killed in a knife fight the day after JFK was shot. I don't think their two incidents were related in any way, but that's where the song comes from.
Next support band are the Choir Cult? How'd you say?
The Circle.
Oh, sorry, right. The Circle. Crazy spelling, crazy guys.
Crazy guys.
Yeah.
The catchiest song ever written and co-written by...
Paul Simon. And they got named by John Lennon.
Yeah. So they were originally called the Rondells. Nat Weiss, Brian Epstein's lawyer in New York, sort of came across them, recommended them to Brian. Brian took them on. John said, Rondells, terrible name, Circle with a Y and a K.
Perfect. Shall we have a little listen to their big... This is going to get into your brain. Co-written by Paul Simon. This is Red Rubber Ball, their big smash hit single.
You bid me farewell. There's a lesson to be learned from this, and I learned it very well.
Check out the double guitar.
If I never hear your name again, it's all the same to me. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the storm is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball.
So where are they now? Here they are. Hooray! Look at this guy. Look at this. Look at that guy.
For secrets I can find. For you I'm just an ornament. Something for your pride.
This guy's crazy. He's in a pool. He's in a pool.
So the minutes of time were all you had to give. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball.
Okay, that's enough. What a great song.
That was a great song.
That was a great song.
Just good to play. See they're still around.
Yeah, it's interesting to see what people got up to during COVID. we're not at the end of the support acts.
We're not at the end of the support acts. So we've got the Ronettes. Now, I've written down here, the Ronettes have not had a top 20 hit in 3 years, but the Beatles and the Ronettes enjoyed each other's company. And fans of the Ronettes may notice that Ronnie Spector is not there. So Phil would not let Ronnie Spector go on the tour because he was paranoid, strange to say.
Phil Spector,
he's a reasonable guy.
The Phil Spector.
He would not let her go on tour because he was jealous of her relationship with the Beatles. And obviously he had nothing to worry about at all.
Hold on, there's another picture here. Oh, goodness me. They seem to be enjoying each other's company quite a lot. But let's get back to the matter in hand. On the night in question, the Beatles take to the stage at 9:27 and they perform 11 songs. And considering that this is, you know, hot, experimental 1966, they're still doing these very regressive...
It's a very 1964-65 set list. So they open with rock and roll music, She's a Woman, If I Needed Someone, the only George Harrison song they ever played live, Day Tripper, Babies in Black.
Babies in Black, yeah, Stephen's favourite.
I Feel Fine, Yesterday, I Want to Be Your Man, Nowhere Man, Paperback Writer, only 66 song, and Long Tall Sally.
And it's an odd kind of existence for them. There's 200 police guards hired to protect them. There's obviously no crowds on the pitch. They're playing in a cage. When you see these pictures from the evening, there's like a cage around them, which is like big visual metaphor. And, you know, we've got a little bit of soundless footage from the night. Let's see where we're at here. There we go. Some people are going to try and make a break for it to get to the boys. Hooray, there they are.
As you see, they've hired the English rugby team. can't catch them.
I don't get rugby jokes myself. So the thing is that this is obviously a big deal. The end of a tour.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, where's Brian?
Where's Brian? You think Brian would be there for the last ever gig, but he's not in San Francisco. He's in LA looking for a briefcase that has been stolen. This is a briefcase. So this is a briefcase that had been stolen. And according to Rolling Stone, it contained legally questionable pills, explicit love letters, steamy Polaroid photos of his young male friends, and $20,000 in cash to be handed out as a bonus to the band.
And do we know who stole the suitcase?
It was stolen by Diz Gillespie.
No way.
Yeah.
Diz Gillespie.
Do you know Diz Gillespie? Diz, not personally. Diz Gillespie was one of Brian's boyfriends. He was American. They'd met in New York. Brian had flown him to London. They were in a relationship for a few months. The Beatles met him, didn't like him. He was really the only boyfriend of Brian's that they'd ever met. Brian put him on a retainer of £50 a week.
Which I like to point out is twice as much
that Mal was paid at the time. Mal was paid 25 quid a week. John Diz Gillespie got 50 quid a week.
But I'm guessing that Diz Gillespie was doing things that Mal... not within his remit.
Maybe not. Okay. But yeah, he's kind of not a... He's not good influence.
No, he's not a nice guy. But they had met, as I say, in 1965, whenever Brian was in New York.
And what was he doing? Scylla! Hooray, there she is.
On the Ed Sullivan Show.
So how does that bleed into 66 then?
They had reconnected. So they had split, they had reconnected and in Los Angeles, spent the night, wakes up in the morning, the briefcase is gone. So while the last concert is happening, Brian's attention is completely focused because of the drugs that are in the case, but also because of these letters and photographs. And we know that he got the briefcase back because, like all of these things, it turns up years later, September 2019, in an auction.
This is the actual case?
Yeah, so the actual case...
Yeah, it was smaller.
I suppose the question that we should ask, in 2019, how much would you be prepared to pay for Brian Epstein's briefcase?
You don't get the steamy Polaroids or the drugs or any of that stuff. Just the case.
Just the case. Empty case. Any bids?
Any offers? Oh, $3,000. Not
bad. $3,000. That's pretty much it. It was £3,437.50. I would have paid that.
Would you have paid that?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get back to the gig. Paul is one of the people who's aware that it's, you know, this looks like the end, and he gets Tony Barrow to make a recording for him.
Yeah. So Tony, or Tiny Barrow, as I mistakenly called him recently. That's a very good photograph of the cage. You can see that they're the way they're playing. So yeah, Tony, or Tiny Barrow, said there was a sort of end of term spirit thing going on. There was also this feeling amongst all of us around the Beatles that this might just be the last concert. I remember Paul casually at the very last minute saying, "Have you got your cassette recorder with you?" And I said, "Of course." And Paul said, tape the show," which I did, literally just holding the microphone up in the middle of the field as a personal souvenir of the occasion. It was a nice thing to have. The only difference was it was not a spectacular occasion. Nothing like Shea Stadium. There was nothing special about it at all, except the Beatles did put in extra ad libs and link materials between the shows. Normally they sort of restricted themselves to, that was this song, this is this song.
Yeah, and the tape is only a 30-minute tape, so almost as some kind of big symbolic ending. It doesn't even record the whole gig. The last song is Long Tall Sally, and it just runs out.
It just stops in the middle of the recording, which I think is kind of fitting.
Yeah, and Paul kind of realizes this on the flight. When they're leaving, Tony Barrow said in his book, "As our plane prepared to take off after the gig, Paul's head came over the top of my seat. Did you get anything on tape? I passed the tape recorder back to them. I got the lot, except for the bit. The tape ran out in the middle of Long Tall Sally." And he was happy to get all the kind of ad-lib remarks as well, which we have some clips of them because they're quite illuminating.
Yes.
So this first one, you're going to hear, you know, there's a bit of uncertainty about whether or not they're going to be carrying on. Okay, that's enough of that. It's not the top quality. We've one other clip of the stage banter, and there's a bit of a reference here to the butcher's sleeve. We think there's a bit of free association going on. I'll get out of the way so everyone can read it. Sing, Now, they don't totally sound like a band without live ability. There's this kind of narrative that says, oh, we couldn't hear ourselves, we were no good. They're not no good. You know, no, that's no. Rollicking.
Yeah. I mean, when they are together, they are still able to perform. But it's the circumstances in which they find themselves. So supposedly, for example, John plays In My Life, just a few notes from In My Life at the end, but it's not on tape. You can't hear it. Nobody in the stadium could hear it. I think it's just one of those sort of little myths. But you can see they're immediately bundled into an armored car, driven by Margaret Franks from Fraserburgh.
Not true.
No.
George Martin, the taxi driver.
Yes.
No. Callback.
No.
No. Okay. And George says famously afterwards on the flight, I'm not a Beatle anymore.
Yeah. That's so this is the source of it's on the plane. That's it. I'm not a Beatle anymore. And I think that pronouncement linked to the end of touring. We're not touring. I'm not a Beatle anymore. So keep that in mind, the circumstances in which he's saying that.
And the narrative that they weren't very good, they try and lock into that pretty early. There's an interview Paul gives, you know, soon after to Judy Sims from Teen Set, saying the band's future, we're not very good performers, actually. We're better in the recording studio where we can control things and work on it until it's right. With performing, there's so much that can go wrong and you can't go back over it and do it right. So they're talking themselves into this new existence.
Yeah.
But something we touched upon earlier on is this notion that there is a bit of torch or a baton being handed over to San Francisco in a way.
Yeah, so 65, 66, London is the absolute center of youth culture for the world. By 67, it's San Francisco. So the first be-in is starting happening in San Francisco. And Jonathan Gould, this is a book that I recommend if anybody's looking for a single volume biography of the Beatles. It's called Can't Buy Me Love by Jonathan Gould. It's just a fantastic book. And he says that people like Ralph Gleason in 67 are trying to turn San Francisco into America's Liverpool. So it's a conscious shift from the UK to the West Coast.
Yeah, and it's just 12 months later where George is kind of walking among the throngs and Haight-Ashbury and sort of rethinking his entire life, more or less. But there is an impact into them giving up the live shows because, you know, there's this notion that this is what kept the group.
Yeah. So there's an author, Kevin Currier, wrote an article called Artificial Paradise, and he said, playing in front of a live crowd, despite its hazards, kept the group's identity intact. As long as they stayed on the road, the inner tensions of each group member were sublimated into the greater good of the band and the greater good of its audience. So as long as we're back to this idea that they're a band of brothers, that those bonds that are forged in that Dormabille tour of Scotland back in 1960 is still there. They're still, you know, they're not staying in massive hotel suites. They're still rooming two to a room. They're still traveling in armored one van. It's just a big, slightly bigger, more heavily armored van than a Dormabille. They're still that band of four people while they're on the road.
Yeah, it's still them against the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're four friends who had gone through some extraordinary experiences together. Here's a little clip with some images from Candlestick Park and Paul doing Yesterday. Play a little bit. Don't want to tear up too much.
No,
it's just too emotional.
No, it's too much.
There's a couple of really insightful, definitive images from that night. So let's start with this one, which I think is your favourite. I'll get out of the way again.
Yeah, good. this really is my favourite, possibly my favourite photograph of the Beatles. I mean,
The Beatles.
You know, you can kind of see 70s Paul emerging.
Look, he's got a little double chin. He's kind of, it's almost like he's saying, in 10 years' time, I'll be filling these stadiums and I'll look a little bit like this, having the laugh. But there's a lovely bit of eye contact there. They're saying so much.
Just sort of that connection between the two of them, I think, is very nice.
We also have one of the selfies. which is John's selfie from the night in question. Now you get off the stage.
I get off the stage.
Which, you know, John just, you know, putting a camera up on an amp, realizing what's going on. And then we've got the man leaving the cage, which is Ringo, the blur of Ringo.
And I mean, I think that does, I mean, that shows you the circumstances in which they're playing. I mean, he's literally climbing out of a cage to get off that stage.
So that is their last gig. And it's worth reminding ourselves what ages they were when they came off the stage that night. If you can't see that, Ringo's 26, Paul is 24, John is 25, George is 23. 23 years of age. What had you done by the time you were 23?
I don't have time to tell you.
But it's the point we're trying to make is that, you know, the story that began on the bus going around Scotland with Johnny Gentle is the thread that carries through into this night here. The next stage that they get to is, you know, this is kind of where we end up eventually. So it's all hugely important.
Yeah, so you think of that 6 years from 1960 to 1966, where they are crisscrossing the UK, crisscrossing the US, going across the world, that the strain of that, and what allows them to withstand that is that friendship, that camaraderie. The fans, the adoring fans, the people who are here in this room tonight, the fans have put them in a position where they're in this bubble, in a cage, literally in Candlestick Park, they are in a cage. And one of the things, a quote that I find from George about why they stopped touring, and this was in the early 70s, and he said, "It became less fun for us than it was for you." And by you, he means all of us. So the fans had put them in that cage and it just wasn't fun.
Yeah. And so by 1966, you know, the Beatles had been on the road for the better part of 6 years. So beginning with kind of the formative experience of the Johnny Gentle tour in 1960, this is a band that had toured before they had an established act or were an established act, before they were even a band. You know, by 1960, they're just friends. They're just in a gang. But that 1960 tour is kind of the start of that bonding, the ambition that kind of gets them to Candlestick Park.
Yeah, and as Paul sort of indicated in that interview, it coincides with better studio technology, different recording techniques, their songwriting is becoming more sophisticated. So those two things sort of come together at the same time and that inform the decision and make it a logical decision. So even if you didn't have the pressure of the fans, the cage, the armored trucks, the sophistication of their music is changing. It coincides, and I think it's an inevitable decision that they stop touring. But I think, as far as I'm concerned, I think people are always saying, well, why did the Beatles break up, or when did they start breaking up, or when did they start pulling apart? And people talk about, you know, Alan Klein, about Yoko, about this, that, the other. For me, I think it's once they stop being those four guys in the cage, in the van, that's when it starts, because it allows them to go off and do their own things. It allows them to grow up, because they've been doing this since they were 17 years of age, George and Paul. They grow up and they grow apart. They get their own interests and they start pulling in different ways. And I don't think it's any coincidence that whenever Paul is saying in Get Back, we need to reconnect with ourselves, we need to reconnect with the audience. And how he sees that happening is we go do a tour. We go and play small clubs. He's trying to do that. And as soon as Wings are together, what does he do with Wings? He puts them in the back of a van and tours them around British universities, English universities for a week, trying to recapture that spirit from Scotland in 1960.
Yeah, so that this notion is that, you know, they began to break up when they came off the road, you know. You know, the first tour in 1960 is the key moment in their career, you know, where Mark Lewisohn says that weekend or that week, that those dates of the 18th and 19th of May, you know, a turning point in their lives. But then the second turning point is
stopping touring.
Yeah.
That's the big second pivotal moment, as important as those 2 days in May in 1960.
But what do you think, everybody? We remain available in all the usual places. We want to thank you all for coming out tonight. My name's Jason Carty. His name is Stephen Cockcroft. We've been nothing but real. Thank you very much. Can you do a pretend drop off? Yeah, we can do a pretend drop off. I feel the need to stand up for the Q&As. I'm kind of...
We've got three questions.
This is like after a proper recording session where I have made a huge mess and you're quite neat. That's very impressive.
And he had the clipboard.
I did
like
the clipboard.
To point out, he had the clipboard. Okay.
Let's do some Q's and A's. Do you want to start?
Oh, I got a guy. Right, okay. I'm going to lead with this one. I don't know who's... This is a nameless. What, in your esteemed opinions, that's a good start.
That's nice.
Are the single worst things about give my regards to Broadstreet?
Oh, no, no.
But there are four. Ian, did you send
this back? Ian, is that yours, Ian?
I'm a big fan of Broadstreet.
I'm a big fan of Broadstreet.
Well, we know this wasn't Ian Lee.
Yeah.
But also, well, there are four options. Worst thing about Broadstreet, worst thing about Sometime in New York City, worst thing about All Things Must Pass. There's nothing worse.
The third disc.
And Revolver.
Ooh, Dr. Robert is my least favorite Revolver track. You have to have one. It's like saying, you know, we all have a least favorite child, you know? So, don't we?
Okay.
Sorry.
Revolver, I think Yellow Submarine, because I think Yellow Submarine and Eleanor Rigby should have been a standalone single, and Paperback Writer and Rain should have been on the album. There is nothing wrong with All Things Must Pass. Sometime in New York City, the worst thing about that is they didn't give us the 40-minute version of Don't Worry, Kyoko from December 69. And we don't have enough time to deal with what's wrong with Broad Street.
Broad Street is just, we could talk about it for hours.
Get up here.
It's just, it's fascinating. It becomes more fascinating with time because obviously he thinks he can be as free with film as he can with how he records. And it's a mess. And he's just not a good actor. But it's fascinating to watch. And if it had been released differently, like as a cable movie thing or a HBO thing or a glorified video album, it wouldn't really have done the thing. But it's the kind of the size of the fall attached to it that caused the problems.
Good try.
I've got a good one.
Okay.
I like this. Is it true or is it just a myth, Stephen, that Nothing Is Real only agreed to come and do a live show in England when you knew the Beatles were back at number one?
Yes. This is true.
That's very true. You'd swear we planned all of this. You'd swear we planned anything.
Yeah,
but
well, Apple got in touch and said, we don't know how to market this.
Yeah.
This is from Ewan McKenzie. What is the closest you've come to meeting a Beatle?
Huh.
So I've never met a Beatle, but I did walk past George Martin in Soho Square and just kind of went and he nodded and smiled, and I think we shared a moment.
Okay. I met Pete Best, which was very nice to meet Pete Best.
Yeah.
I have to admit, very strange. Here's a question that won't take 10 hours. What is it about the Beatles? Who wrote that? What is it, Stephen, about the Beatles?
I don't know.
Okay.
This is from Alan from Dundee via Five Guys. We bumped into Alan in Five Guys and we were enjoying a sumptuous pre-show repast. And he says, when Giles remixes a song, do you replace the last version on your iPod or iPhone, or do you keep all the versions?
Well, we haven't done a big Giles Now and Then Red Blue discussion. I'm sure it's all on the horizon.
He's not been on the Facebook group.
I know, I don't
do
Facebook for some reason. You say you're
right.
Because we don't totally agree.
I can do about 45 minutes on this. Giles, I like some of what Giles does. I don't like some of what Giles does. I do not replace the original versions. I tend to listen to the 2009 remasters. I don't particularly listen to any of the remixed albums and box sets. I listen to the outtakes. I'm resigned to the fact that these remixes are not for me. And I can't really see everybody, but I'm not sure how many people there are here under 25.
I think it's most of them, Stephen.
But I think the remixes are not probably for anybody in this room. I think what they're doing is they're new mixes for new ears listening on new delivery systems, new speakers. They're very much focused on streaming. They've turned their back on the physical product, and I think the very fact that they have stopped including Blu-rays with Atmos mixes and 5.1 in the physical box sets shows that that's their focus. And I think I was not happy about that, but a friend of mine, a guy called Jeff Bailey, and I were talking about it, and he said, what is more important? Is it more important to spread the message or to preserve the sacred scrolls? And I think if you think of it that way, I think it's more important to spread the message. So I'm resigned to the fact.
Yes.
That, these are not for me. They're for the young folks.
Get these new mixes off my lawn is what I'm hearing. These new remixes are terrible and such small portions, etc., etc. I quite like the new remixes because I quite enjoy bubbles being burst and, you know, people being wound up about things. I think it's kind of funny. I do, some of them I don't understand. I haven't had a proper sit down to listen to Red and Blue in all the different versions. And, you know, some people do A, B versions. I'm going to sit down and listen to this compared to the other. The things that do stick out, though, they're, you know, Old Brown Shoe just sounds terrible.
Yeah.
And but some of the other things sound
great.
Intermediate age brand shoe sounds terrible, but Yesterday sounds amazing, I think.
Sounds amazing.
I didn't have any problem with the remixes up until we get to Revolver, where I really felt things went a little bit out of kilter.
The new Eye on the Walrus, people have heard it? Yes.
Yes.
No?
No.
No.
I like it, and it keeps to, but it does, the new stereo mix, it seems to go back to mono with the overwhelming radio noise at the end, so that's a bit of the end. I kind of like the fact that it's
just
so different.
For me, that crosses the line into an artistic decision rather than a production decision.
I told you we could do 40 minutes.
Yeah, we could do 40 minutes. We'll save for the end of year episode.
Can I read this one out?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, go on.
Okay. Which solo Beatles live album would you most like to do a podcast on? Listen and find out. That's what I was thinking.
Have we done it? I can't remember. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've just remembered. Here's a question from Michelle in Dublin. She's following us.
She's following us.
How did she get here?
Is Margaret Overall related to Sue Cement Mixer? I think that's just a silly question. Richard has said, Mark Lewison said he would like to go back and correct the errors in TuneIn. Are there any episodes that you would like to go back and correct? Well, I would have liked to have put out the right episode this morning. That would have helped. It would have helped.
It would have helped.
It calmed the nerves.
Yeah, I think it was something I got a lot of flack for from one particular person. So that's not a lot of flack.
But it was a lot of flack.
I think I said they used the guitar solo from Taxman at the end of Tomorrow Never Knows. And of course they didn't. They just recorded a Taxman-like guitar solo. So that's my big mistake.
Yeah. Are there any other episodes? I know there's one episode we did that you really don't like, and I'm not going to say what it is, but there's one that I think of, and it's the one that... But you'll have to just guess which one it is.
Answers on a postcard. Answers on a postcard. Here's one from James Lovell. Which Beatles show would you most like to have seen? I've only been given three options: Cavern, Beatlemania, or Rooftop. I think probably Rooftop.
Hmm.
Controversial.
What were the three choices? Rooftop, Cavern, or
Beatlemania.
Oof. Cavern. You can tell me what the Rooftop was like, and I'll tell you what the Cavern was like. seems sensible. Let's think. Paul McCartney's people get in touch and he will answer one question from both of you and record the answer. What is the question? What are the two questions? One for each of us.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You think we know this because we have a list of questions for Paul.
Back to the egg box set. What's the skinny?
What's the crack?
What's going on? That's all I want.
Yeah, I'm a simple man. Do you have one question for Paul? Why are you alive? That's quite threatening.
That is quite threatening.
The look in your Stephen's eyes.
I suppose I'd just like to set him down and have a good long chat about Alan Klein and, the business stuff.
How he wasn't such a bad guy.
Why did he buy those shares? Yeah. That's right. Why did you buy those shares, Paul?
There's one question.
He hasn't arrived yet, no.
He's not here, no.
Okay. Here's one from Richard Adams.
Oh, I've got
Is there anything about the Beatles that you both will never agree about? Well, you've already mentioned Broad Street.
Yeah, there's the Paul George thing. Yeah. That's a bit of fun.
Is it?
Yeah. What else is there that we don't agree on?
We agree on everything.
No, we don't. It's interesting how there's an awful lot of music we don't agree on. The Beatles is probably a significant intersection.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? I mean, but within the Beatles, there are individual songs I don't like. I mean, it's well known, and I'm standing here. I don't like Babies in Black. I don't like Yes, It Is.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. Everything else is fine. I like that.
Well, by an extension, while we're in a negative space, not literally, what do you hate about the Beatles? I hate the money-grubbing BS, says Joel. What do you hate about the Beatles?
Put that in the prize bag.
What do you hate about the Beatles?
Not much.
I think
the commercialism is more on display now. I mean, I'm not naive enough to think that it was never about money. It was never about the commercial side, but I'm happier if that's hidden. You know, if I don't know that people are putting their hand in my pocket. Is that too controversial?
No, I don't think that's too controversial. I'm not sure what I hate about the Beatles. I wish I could listen to them again for the first time.
This is from
I know them.
Reserved. this is a vote. AB, right? The A's on A Day in the Life. John? Paul?
Okay.
There you go.
Well, that seemed a bit unclear. So we're talking about the A's in A Day in the Life. From yesterday, somebody spoke and I went into a dream. Paul or John? If you think it's John, go yes.
Yes.
If you think it's Paul, go yes.
Yes.
Well, we've decided once and for all. here's a nice one. Do you realise how important Nothing Is Real was to everyone during the lockdown? Thank you very much, Checks Notes. Say yes.
Has it got a name on that?
No, it doesn't. It was a weird thing. I think lockdown changed the podcast a lot. I think the first season is very different to the lockdown episodes.
Short episodes recorded in the studio, and then once we got free of wherever it was, it just got longer and longer.
Well, the
episodes.
Notes. I mean, the first season used to be there'd be about 6 pages of notes.
Yeah.
And now there's a lot of notes.
Mine was 160 pages of notes. Anyway,
that's Steve.
This is a question from Declan McManus.
The one and only.
The one and only Declan McManus. And it is a very Elvis Costello question. He said, Peter Jackson is to remake Let It Be with Paul McCartney appearing as himself and the rest of the cast as Muppets.
Ah.
Who would you cast? Well, I immediately think Sam the Eagle is George Martin.
Okay. I haven't thought about this. I know this came up before.
I can't
remember the things that I thought about the last time.
Okay, well, I just keep going.
You keep going.
I'll keep going. Okay. Well, Paul.
Who? Which one's Hammy Monster?
The Honey Monster.
Honey Monster wasn't a.
He's not a Muppet.
He's John Cooper Clarkson.
He's not a Muppet.
Huh? He's
Muppet adjacent.
He is Muppet adjacent, but I don't think you can cross streams.
We can AI him in. I think Gonzo is Ringo, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
I think Janice has to be Linda. I think George is Floyd Pepper.
Have we chosen John yet?
John.
I feel like I'm on the spot. The only thing I can remember is I always like that guy, New Zealand, who blows things up, and I think that's Magic Alex. That's the other one I can think of.
Billy Preston plays the piano.
So it must be Ralph.
Ralph.
That's
Ralph.
All. Any others, Dave? Who's your John?
Who would you have as...
is that Declan McManus?
Swedish chef is Dave James.
Anyway, the Lennon-McCartney partnership, fact or fiction? You've done an episode on Harrison Starr. When are you going to do a Lennon-McCartney episode?
Every episode is about Lennon-McCartney.
Pretty much, yeah.
Here's a question from Todd Baxter. When are you going to finish writing the follow-up to Tune In? and then he goes, oh, wait. What made your You Know My Name, Look Up the Number, your best episode? And then he goes, oh, wait. What question would you most like to ask each Beatle individually? Paul, why did you buy the shares?
We've done Paul. With Ringo, I would like to talk to Ringo about more about his drumming, you know.
Why did he stop,
you know? And there's so much more drumming he could have done in the post-Beatles. Ringo kind of, he tipped towards entertainment. He's a self-taught drummer, and he kind of reached a plateau where he wouldn't really do any further kind of training or practice or any of those kind of things. And I think it's a pity, because when you hear him drumming, and he has popped up on records in recent years, like he's on a Jenny Lewis record and he's on an Eddie Vedder record, and he's Ringo and he's fantastic. But I think it's a pity he didn't do more popping up the way Jim Keltner did or some other kind of people did. I think it's a huge loss that he kind of leaned into more being the, hey, Ringo kind of show tunes. Yeah. Singing in the pub type Ringo, instead of taking his drumming seriously.
We asked ourselves this question. I don't think we were able to come up with an example of an occasion post-Beatles where Ringo Starr appeared live on stage playing the drums without a second drummer. Usually Jim Keltner. But, you know, if you think of big things like Bangladesh and that type of show, he always has a second drummer. The All-Star Band is a second drummer. So if anybody can think of an occasion, you can let us know.
Do we have to think of other questions then? What question would you ask George?
Can I come and live in Prior Park? That would be my question.
What's your problem, man? My question for George.
I think it was at one of the Dublin events, said, you know, very seriously, and said, why do you like George? How can George be your favorite Beatle? And I was kind of pausing, and Jason stepped in and was able to say, so what you're asking is, what attracted you to the sarcastic, grumpy Beatle with the holier-than-thou attitude? And I thought, that's it. Here's a question for you.
Oh, good.
Which is, you have to answer this or you don't get off the stage. This is from Andy. Thank you, Andy. How many live shows did the Beatles play after they'd signed with Parlophone?
Ooh.
A lot.
But after they signed with Parlophone?
Yeah.
So there's some Hamburg shows.
He didn't say in Hamburg. I mean, ever.
No, but post-signing with Parlophone.
Yeah.
So it's probably not that many.
Well, you've got all those Beatlemania tours and...
It might only be about 700, is it?
Oh, I'm sorry I asked.
Do we know the number? I'm just guessing. That's my guess. Does anyone know the answer?
Nobody knows the answer to that. What would be the best way to keep Peter Jackson busy? A documentary about the anthology sessions? Yes.
Yeah.
We want to know what they were doing in 1995. There's 14 hours, apparently, of footage of them recording in 1995.
Should we talk about the Now and Then video?
Yes.
Come on, it's great, isn't it?
I don't lose a cry.
Well, no, I think the rumor, if you know, Peter Jackson obviously has his hands on anthology material.
Yeah.
He has the 14 hours of sessions from 94. He's spoken about, you know, the possibility of tweaking Free as a Bird and all the rest. And there's a lot of anthology that exists on film stock, so it could be rescanned, re-upgraded, and I think a redo of anthology would make a lot of sense as something to do in the next 2 to 3 years in terms of catching the wave of young people. What I find fascinating about the whole Now and Then experience is how it's affecting younger people, Beatle fans in their late teens, and, you know, social media, that the kind of there's a very strong social media presence of young people who support the Beatles and who love the Beatles. And a lot of them were inoculated on the Get Back documentary, you know, and I think the Get Back is kind of a thing 2 years on, it seems to me that it kind of tipped the Beatles away from being this kind of reverent and, you know, these kind of holy scrolls and, oh, these are the best things of all time, And for a lot of people, seeing the Beatles for the first time turned them into human, and a lot of fun, a lot of crack, really enjoyed seeing them. I think it set up a lot of young people getting involved in the Now and Then experience. And so you see that online. You know, my own kids are kind of really interested in it, and they don't think, they don't have any problem with this notion of here's a song that's been finished. It's still the Beatles. That's just it. So I, you know, they're definitely prepping that generation, and the video is part of that, I think.
So I'd like to see Peter Jackson do that, but then again, we know what he did with the video. My problem with the video is it's got no consistency to it. It's sort of different feel to different sections. And, you know, it's quite funny when John pops up doing his little dance the first time, not so much the second time, and by the third time, you're kind of thinking, can we see something else? I just think it shows, Peter Jackson said, this is my first ever music video, and I thought, well, yeah. You know, anyway, we have a question.
Well, I feel sorry for Peter Jackson, because I think he would have liked to have Paul and Ringo in a green screen room together for 48 hours to get some proper footage. And he was hampered by Paul and Ringo saying, or we could just send you some stuff on our phone and you could blend it in if you want. So I think in fairness, he was a little bit limited in terms of the two guys standing side by side. But the thing that really attracts the eye in the Now and Then video, which I would have thought he would have had the technology to remove, is the thermostat that sits beside Paul's head in the studio. I was like, could you just, I'm not taking away the thermostat. I just find my eyes are just drawn towards the thermostat. And now yours will be too, the next time you watch the Now and Then video. Like, couldn't you have just, okay, taken it out with the, I don't know, it's very annoying.
Okay, we have a question from Shirley. When are you guys going to write a book, and what would it be about? It would be about the Beatles.
It would be about the Beatles. Well,
we could put all the scripts into a book. No one would buy that book.
A book, we're not going to give away any secrets. A book has been discussed. I think Stephen should write the book because he is the literary...
I'm the clever one.
Yeah, pretty much. The one who does the work. We have had an idea for a book, which I think is an idea that hasn't been done before. But the question is trying to find the time to do it. But it would be a good... book idea, but I won't say any more than that.
No, because I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, go.
You do really. In your view, what single song demonstrates the best the individual and collective geniuses of the Beatles? Is that just one single song for the whole entire band? Eek. Strawberry Fields, then, I guess.
I'm going to go with Rain.
Ooh, good choice.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, the bass playing, the drumming, the vocals, you know, Liam Gallagher's got an entire career out of that one song.
Yeah.
You know, the guitar part. I think everything comes together in that one song. And it's a B-side. It's tucked away on a B-side. We're running out of questions.
Yeah, I've only got one left.
This is a question from Darren. We know that Paul is Jason's favourite and George is Stephen's favourite, but who is your least favourite Beatle and why is it John?
Ooh. Why is it John?
Is Darren prepared to put his hand up? No. Oh, there we go. So if anybody wants to take that up with Darren, he's over there. I don't have a least favourite Beatle.
Well, mine is George. I would say it is nice. I know it seems like a very obvious thing, but getting back to Now and Then, it's just because I heard it in the wild the other day. I was literally in the supermarket and it started playing. And it is really striking to hear John Lennon's voice again, just in a pop song context. It's just absolutely wild and fantastic. There's one question which is actually kind of answered by the episodes that are happening at the minute. Can you elaborate on Paul's return to live performing at Live Aid? And were George and Ringo ever asked to join him? And we kind of cover that in our current Press to Play series, which is the album that everybody loves to love, Paul's Press to Play.
I'm going to ask, this is a serious question. People like Press to Play?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, this, apart from Ian Lee, we will change your mind about this album, because I think Press to Play is not only a great album, if you want to know about Paul McCartney and his psyche and the way he works and the way he thinks, that's the album that you need to unlock. And I think if you unlock that album, you learn everything you need to know about Paul post 1980. There you go.
Okay, so it's your Wings Wildlife.
Okay. Having enjoyed listening to the various cover versions of Beatles songs tonight, which is the best cover version of a Beatles song, and why is it Billy Preston's version of Get Back? And that's from the marvelous Sgt. Pepper movie, and that's from Jeff.
The best Beatles cover version?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you which Beatles cover version I hate, and it's Joe Cocker's With a Little Help from My Friends. Is that controversial? It's just like, oh man, it's so awful. But I don't know what the best one is. Probably
the
is
Billy Preston. The best cover version
Stevie Wonder
is Alison Krauss's version of I Will.
Ooh. Oh, deep cut. Yeah, very good.
Thank you,
Jason. Oh, thank you, Stephen. Oh, show big buddies. Hey. Thank you all for coming out tonight. So, right, feels good. Yes, yes, yes. I'm going to cue the music.
Yeah, cue the music.